Welcome to Pining for Penny Pod. I'm Heather.
And I'm Emily. This is a fan podcast to summarize, discuss, and dissect the whole Armand Gamache mystery series by Louise Penny. We are going book by book in the order they were written, just a few chapters at a time.
And most importantly, we're here to enjoy some wine, scotch, beer, cafe au lait, tea, and pretty much any food described in the novels.
Disclaimers, we may have some spoilers for future books, but we will do our best to not ruin any big things. Also, and this is very important, we are not Francophones, nor are we Canadian.
No, actually, we are recording this podcast from lovely Houston, Texas, so please excuse our French.
I was thinking the other day, though, that in that little disclaimer about not ruining anything big, I have a feeling that as we get further through, I'm not going to know what we have talked about and what is coming next.
Yes.
And details are all going to get muddied. So I feel like there's a possibility. And plus now with the show.
I know.
Talking with the about show. Something that it was like, no, that didn't happen. So-and-so actually died. And
we're like, not going to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know what, guys? We're very sorry. That's why we have the disclaimers. It says we may have some spoilers for future books. Like, we're not going to spoil the main murders, probably. But who knows?
Yeah.
And that's why we have a disclaimer. So right. We apologize deeply. We're not doing it on purpose, but it is really hard. This is a massive world. It's
a
massive, it's tiny like one town.
It's like Game of Thrones world.
It's literally Game of Thrones style in one town, though. I'm serious.
Yes, there are many rotating characters.
That we have, you know, the books now, and we have the series now, and we have our podcast. So who's to tell what can happen at any moment?
It's all divergent. Yeah.
Okay, so these Anglophones will attempt to speak French in our That's a French-Ass Name segment. we've been doing pretty poor at French lately. Today we're going to totally redeem ourselves. We're so prepared. We're going to say it right.
Yes.
Okay, the first one is just really easy. It's sous.
Sous.
It just means drunk.
Oh.
And later sous. On in the chapters, I'll bring it back up as to, like, what the reference is in the novel.
Okay.
But if you just like, or maybe it means drunken.
Okay.
I don't know the exact form of the word it is, but basically means you're a big drunk.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And the other one is, moi c'est épouvantable.
That their last word was really good. I think the first one, wait, how did you say it?
I don't even know how I said it.
I think
it.
You said moi.
Moi. Oh. Mais
yeah.
C'est épouvantable. Nope.
Yeah. Mais c'est épouvantable.
Yeah.
You did it. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's
okay. Great.
Go ahead. One more time. Go ahead, one more time.
Mais c'est épouvantable.
Yes.
Table.
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 Yeah.
Table. Yeah, we did it. And what does it mean?
Oh, but it's terrible.
Oh, that's sad. Yeah. Is it sad?
I mean, anything in the Book of Murder.
Right. Very true. All right, shall we get into our first weekly investigative report? Where we summarize the chapters from this week's reading? Just in case you guys didn't know what the weekly investigative report is.
Exactly.
Chapter 31.
Chapter 31, skis. All right. This is going to be a long podcast, guys, so just kind of settle in, buckle up.
There's
A lot's happened. All right. Chapter 31. Throughout the other podcast, we've been mentioning how Gamache is just pilfering these books.
Stop. Is he still collecting more?
Well, I feel like he finally kind of calls himself out for collecting, air quotes, collecting
not these stealing.
Books. Not stealing. From the crime scenes. And I think he mentions where, like, other people collect evidence. He's collecting books. And he is going to be sharing his findings with Myrna, who... They're finally hanging out of the bistro, sitting down with some scotch or their drink of choice. And they're going over the book. So he's pulling them out of his pocket, handing them over to Myrna. And then she sees one that she's at, like, she's horrified to see it. And it's the Sarah Binks one. Mm. And Gamache is like, oh, why does this horrify you? I don't think she ever really gets into it. But then they move on. And they're talking about something else. But,
It's okay.
Reading my notes here. a lot happened. So they start talking about the books, but then they move on to start talking about Monsieur Boulevet.
Oh, okay.
Boulevet. Who they also see, who's sitting at the bar.
Okay. So they're talking about, please don't fall off the chair.
So we're doing this podcast at my apartment this time, and I have these stools that are very tippy. It's fine. So they're noticing Monsieur Boulevet, mm-hmm. who's sitting at the bar, and he's looking really depressed, and they're like, oh, but yes, he just lost two women that he was very close to and cared about. And I thought this was interesting, and I meant to actually look it up, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. Myrna, who we know is a psychologist in a previous life, she starts talking about, you know, in reference to Monsieur Boulevet, is he actually sad or is something else going on? And she talks about the near enemy. Is he experiencing the near enemy? And Gamache is like, what is that?
He's so intrigued.
And it's the idea that there are these two emotions that are very, like, closely tied. Like, I think of, like, love and hate. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, like, a very fine line.
Pain and pleasure.
Ooh, yes, exactly. Exactly. Or, yeah, there's a fine line between them. And so she goes through and she's like, well, there's attachment, pretending to be love, pity as compassion, and then equanimity as indifference. Hmm. And they kind of hit on this one, which I thought was kind of interesting, than more interesting than the others. And Myrna says that this is in reference to people who seem really calm on the outside, you know, in like face of like some kind of tragic experience, loss of a loved one or, you know, crisis or something. They seem really calm, but then in actuality, they just have zero emotion. Oh. And they're just kind of more like psychopathic.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. It'd be hard to distinguish, right?
It could be, yeah. So there are the people who, you know, recover quickly because they're, like, very resilient. And then there are people who seem to recover quickly, but they really had nothing to recover from. So, yeah. So that's what they're wondering about. Monsieur Boulevet. Boulevet. If that's what he's experiencing. So, moving along. While Gamache and Myrna are cracking it up at the bistro, Nicole and Zhangyi are in the incident room.
They're just the two of them. Oh, that's so good.
The two of them. And they're about to leave when Nicole, her phone's ringing. She's trying to play it off like, oh, that's not my phone. Someone else's. And Zhangyi is like, give me your phone.
Answer that.
Yeah, right now. Don't get to it in time. Nothing's on the other end.
But he's suspicious.
He's very suspicious. And then Zhangyi and Gamache have that classic sit down in the bistro. They eat some delicious food. They talk about the murder case. Mm. Apparently, Myrna has left. And then Zhangyi and Gamache are talking about the yearbook. And they're starting to think that maybe Jean potentially went to school with Mad. Not quite sure about that yet.
Okay.
And then they finish. That chapter rounds out and talking about the discussion, or they're discussing Mad's heart condition, and whoever killed her had to have known about it.
Right.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have died from Mia Pedro alone without the heart condition.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
So lots of info.
Yes.
I almost just fell again.
One of us is going to die.
This is going to happen multiple times in this podcast.
Like a little Russian roulette.
Who's going to fall? Near you.
I wonder who people would think would fall.
Let us know.
Yeah.
Email us. Don't tweet us.
Definitely don't tweet us. Do it. We don't have a tweet, right?
I don't know. I set one up, but I have no idea if we ever post.
I don't
know
if I'd want to be on Twitter with everything that's going on with Twitter.
Yeah, I don't even. Yeah, it's fine. We don't need one.
Nope. Okay. So we're done with our summary. Quick quote corner.
Corner? Guana.
Corner.
Cornier. I just made that up. I don't know what that
That's
is.
Very Cornier with you. Yeah. So where we highlight our favorite quotes from the chapter we just reviewed. So one of the quotes, obviously, is just highlighting Olivier's personality. And they are, I think they're in the incident room. They're in the incident room. Olivier walks in. The quote is, "Just then, Olivier appeared with their dinner. Beauvoir was doubly pleased. Not only did he get his food, but it stopped..." Oh, sorry. This is a completely different quote. I have a different quote. All right. This is not in the incident room. This is when they're at the bistro.
Okay. Okay. I was liking the quote so far, though.
Yes. And Gamache is... he's starting to recite some poetry, as he does.
Oh, no.
And then, just then, Olivier appeared with their dinner. Beauvoir was doubly pleased. Not only did he get his food, but it stopped the chief from reciting more poetry.
That's literally perfection for him.
Yeah, so that's Beauvoir's.
So we're going to need to post this picture so that everyone knows what our view is today for our podcast, because it's ridiculous.
She's almost sleeping with her mouth.
Stretchy. So we don't have Riley here today with us because we're at Emily's apartment, but we have two little friends, Sabina and Bond.
My cute cats.
And Sabina is very comfy on the couch over there. We have to upload that picture.
We will.
Okay. Yes. No more poetry, please. Gamache.
No.
Thank you.
No.
Although I love
No, I love it. My, I love it. I'm
I love
kidding.
my mind's voice of Gamache.
And
yes. Just absolutely. See him sitting peacefully with a glass of scotch in his hand in front of a fire.
Reciting poetry. So speaking
of the bistro and the bistro brief, the food that appeared. Whew, all right. So there was wine, and there was scotch, and there was mixed nuts that was with Myrna and Gamache. And then the food that Gamache and Zhangyi eat.
Just the two of them? They order all this.
Just like super cash, no big deal. Appetizer, lobster bisque, rich taste of lobster, lightly flavored with cognac.
Oh, okay.
And French onion soup.
Okay, so two soups.
Two soups, okay. Yep. Dinner was coq au vin with soft warm bread dipped in gravy, charred broiled steak in pan-fried onions with a mound of frites, and then dessert was creme brulee.
Okay, Emily, I just have to say that I'm highly insulted that you didn't make the full course meal for us tonight. Just kidding.
I mean, some did.
So, as you might have guessed, we had a lot of options to choose from for what we're eating today, but both Emily and I, since reading these books like a while ago, like probably even before the podcast, we've always wanted to try the coq au vin.
Yeah.
It just looks and sounds so good. And Emily did it.
I did. I bought a new, for Christmas, early Christmas present from my mother was a Dutch oven from H-E-B. Just going to put
that little
plug in there. It's quite a beautiful little.
It is really pretty.
Dutch oven.
Mm-hmm. I really like the gold or bronze.
Mm-hmm.
Gold?
I think bronze.
Bronze accent, and it's like a solid black Dutch oven. It's very pretty, and it makes really delicious food.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say it was a huge success. It was savory, definitely like complex. You could taste the wine, and it was very greasy and delicious.
There was a lot of bacon fat.
Yeah. Everything was
everything
in bacon,
soaked in the bacon fat,
including Emily.
Yes, yeah. So while I was cooking it, the bacon, the pancetta, all of the fat was like splashing all over the place. It was like a regular fountain of fat just splashing. And then when you have to sear the chicken, it makes it, of course, splash more. Mm-hmm. It's getting on my face. And then probably an hour later, I'm sitting and I'm like licked my lips. And I tasted something salty, and I'm like, I haven't worked out today. I was like, oh, no. I just taste like bacon.
You're like, that's not my flavor.
No.
I'm not that delicious. My gosh. Okay, well, thank you so much for making that. It was really delicious. And we're having some red wine with it, and we did have some
delicious French bread.
Mm-hmm. And guys, make it. It's worth it.
Yeah. It really is. Yes. And if you need to see what it is, Google New York Times Coke, C-O-Q-A-U, Vin, V-I-N. Google New York Times Coca Vin, and you will see the most beautiful video of someone preparing this meal.
Or just look at our photos, because ours are beautiful.
Yes, they are. But
on your beautiful new plates?
Oh, yep. That's another early Christmas present. I got some beautiful vintage clay.
Mm-hmm. Hand-painted.
Yeah, bowls.
So, are you going to get any Christmas presents on actual Christmas, Emily? No, I'm just kidding.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. We'll see.
Who knows? My mom, she like squirrels things away and she forgets about them throughout the year. And then every once in a while, they'll pop up. She's like, oh, I meant to give this to you.
And you're like, thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. So let's move on to our weekly investigative report for chapter 32. So we are in the mind of Jean Chauvet. Mm-hmm. And she is thinking about how magical Three Pines is. And so she saw it on a brochure, like before she came there. And when she saw the brochure, she knew she had to go and she knew her life was going to change. And you're like, oh, okay. Like, mm-hmm. It seemed like she thought it was going to change like for the better, because she said she thought it saved her life. Hmm. So what was going on in her life before she came to Three Pines? That's a little mystery. We don't really know.
Have you ever had that feeling?
I think more after the fact. Hmm. Like, I don't think not in the moment. But have you?
Trying to think.
I think I definitely have thought back and been like, that moment changed my life.
Okay.
But, yeah, if you think of something.
Yeah,
let me know. Shout it out. We'll pause.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that is a really interesting, you know, idea.
I mean, there's the possibility. You talk about magical stuff, like that New York trip that I took. Mm-hmm. When everything just worked out perfectly, that Joy Olakadun, I'm sorry, will someday learn how to pronounce my favorite artist.
She was going to be there at the same time.
Yeah, I was going to go to Woodstock, which is like a huge, you know, huge history behind it, mm-hmm. for music. I did feel like that was going to be a magical experience, and it was.
And it was.
Yeah. She just played at the White House yesterday.
Oh, really?
For the Marriage Act, for signing that.
Really?
She performed.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wait, I didn't know she was like that.
She's, yeah. Yeah.
I thought she was like some obscure artist, to be honest. Just.
I do feel like she's kind of obscure, but I think that she's growing quite a bit.
I need to listen to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's my phone.
She just, there was a new movie that came out where she has a song in there.
Type it into my what is it called? iMusic? Music? Not iTunes. What is this thing called? Apple Music?
Apple Music.
Guys, remember iTunes?
Yeah.
I was just talking about this with my husband the other day. Remember iTunes?
Yeah, do you remember iTunes? I barely remember iTunes because I'm so not technologically savvy.
Yeah. I hardly
took
advantage of it.
Mm-mm. But I have an iTunes account.
I mean, I don't think it's used anymore because of Apple Music. Like, right. I think it's just there, but very outdated.
Yeah.
Now everything's so much easier. Okay. So, anywho, she thought it was going to change her life. Mm-hmm. But then, and she showed up to Three Pines, and then she saw Madeline. And she was, quote, in her head again.
Oh.
So, one, we find out that clearly Jean Chauvet was in a bad place before she came to Three Pines. And two, she knew Madeline. We didn't know that. As far as we knew, we didn't, you know? Mm-hmm. Okay. So Gamache and Beauvoir sit with Jean Chauvet at the bistro and they're chatting and they order a crap ton of beverages, which I'll talk about later. I'll tell you in the bistro brief. It's like ridiculous. And mm-hmm. I was very confused. Like, were they mixing them or were they three separate beverages? It was great.
Okay.
It was great. Okay, so Jean tells them about her past and when she realized that she was a psychic. So it was kind of like childhood. Yep. And so she realized she was a psychic and that she saw the world differently from others when she was at a birthday party. Mm-hmm. And she knew what was in all the birthday presents before they were opened.
Yes. Okay.
And, like, yeah, she, Gamache kind of wondered, like, oh, like, was that isolating for you?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that must have been hard or whatever. Like, were you made fun of?
Did you ever have moments like that when you were a kid where you felt kind of clairvoyant or?
Absolutely not.
No?
No.
Did you ever have, like, magical thinking?
No. I don't know. What do you mean?
Well,
I'm assuming you have an example.
I do have an
example.
So
let's go.
So, two examples. The first one is ridiculous.
Okay.
So, more often than not, when I was putting my clothing away in my closet, I would just randomly grab a number of hangers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'd be like, oh, I need one more. Without really knowing exactly how many I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, I had the exact number of hangers that I needed. And I was like, and it happened frequently enough that I was like, oh, this is weird. Like, I just randomly going in. I don't know how much clothing is on my bed, but I'm going in grabbing this, and I have the perfect number of hangers.
Maybe you literally have, like, amazing visual memory that you don't – that's, like, subconscious.
Yes. The other thing that I thought was weird – or just intuitive, I don't know. But I would also say more often than not, when the phone rang, I knew if it was going to be my best friend calling or
well,
not.
Yeah, that...
So, I mean, probably around the same time you know, we hadn't necessarily talked about when we were going to talk. But if the phone rang, I'm like, oh, I bet that's, you know, my best friend. Yeah.
And it was.
And it was.
Yeah, I don't think I ever noticed anything like that. I think Emily, you're just a genius.
Maybe. I'm a closet genius.
Or maybe you're psychic.
Maybe.
You could have made money off of that, so maybe you should look into that.
Oh, that's why I'm doing the podcast now. Now it's just getting out in the world.
You're right. And this podcast is going to make us so much money as well.
It will. We can both retire from our jobs.
Yes, I'm ready. Let's go. Let's do it. So she, okay, this is right online with what you were saying.
Yes.
I love this part. And I love that Louise Penny always adds interesting characters that seem slightly fantastical or magical, but like they're just regular people in real life. So she mentions like, oh, I'm actually really like thankful for it. And I'm not like upset by it. Because for example, I never lose my keys. She says, I don't have it that hard. And when she says this, she's looking straight at Zhang-Gi. Like they're having a moment. She's like, I never lose my keys. And she's staring right at him. And then we get into his mind and he's like, I never lose my keys. Am I clairvoyant? Like that's like, seriously, he's like in his mind freaking out. And then you're in his mind and he says, he just had this feeling. So he called his mom and was like, yo, was I born with a call? And she was like, yeah.
What?
Zhang-Gi was born with a call.
What? Oh, Zhang-Gi.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's so hard for him to, like, accept this because it's, like, you know, magical, right?
Right.
Like, it's like, oh, you're either cursed or you're blessed if you were born with a call or whatever. And he doesn't believe that kind of crap. But then he's, like, staring down the eyes of Jean Chauvet, who's like, I never lose my keys.
Right.
And he's like, oh my God. And then he just kind of has this eye-opening moment where he's like, maybe that's why I'm in homicide and like why I like this job and why, you know what I mean? He's able to like solve these murders and stuff. And then he starts to feel like a little bit bad for mocking Gamache for like, you know, relying on intuition and other like faith-based methods and not just like the facts. It's a fun moment for
him. Well, I feel like intuition can go a really long way.
Agreed. And it's you just can't explain it.
Right.
There's just something going on that we can't explain.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Okay. So where am I? So they ask her why she came to Three Pines. She tells them about the brochure. And interestingly, above the like B&B, there was like writing on the brochure.
Okay.
And when she gets to Three Pines, the writing is not actually there on the B&B. It does, like, the chapter doesn't tell us what the writing is, but it makes her think that, like, you know, she was supposed to go to Three Pines, like, because she saw that writing. And, you know, she thinks someone put it there for her.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? Whether it's God or
right.
Some sort of force or a real human.
Hmm.
And we don't really know.
Interesting.
And then there's, of course, the confusion continues with where Jean went to high school. And we find out in her mind that she knew Madeline.
Okay.
And when she showed up to Three Pines, Madeline did not recognize her.
Ugh.
And that just bothered her. And she starts going off in her mind, and basically she is thinking of ways that Madeline could get hurt. Hmm. And, quote, it never occurred to her to decline the second seance.
Hmm.
Like, because people were like, oh, it could be dangerous. And she was thinking, like, oh, well, maybe Madeline will get hurt there. That's literally what she's thinking.
Interesting. So did she feel like maybe she willed it to happen in a way, mm-hmm. or like manifested it?
Yeah, that's kind of the feel that you get there. Huh. Or maybe she just wanted to scare her, but she was so mad that she didn't recognize her.
Right.
Like something is going on with them, and it's like annoying that she's not telling them. There's no, that was my quick quote, by the way, was it had never occurred to her to climb the second seance. Okay, so there was no food, but here are all the drinks.
Drinks, okay.
So,
oh my goodness.
No, seriously, they sit down, and it's Jean, Zhang-Yi, and Gamache. And this is what is ordered. An espresso, a brandy, and a Benedictine. That's one person's order. The other person ordered a Tia Maria, creme de menthe, and cognac. And the other person ordered a Cointreau.
What is a Tia Maria?
I don't know what the Tia Maria is, but I did look up what the Benedictine is, because I didn't know what that one was. Did you?
No.
So apparently it has 27 herbs and spices in it.
Sounds amazing.
Right?
Is it like a...
These are all after-dinner liqueurs, essentially.
Okay.
So I think that they're ordering them and, like, drinking them in order. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, because, like, creme de menthe, and then cognac, and then Cointreau. Like,
yes.
I'm just kidding. Like,
right.
It's not a drink put together, right?
Oh. Tia Maria is a coffee liqueur invented in Jamaica in the 1940s.
Okay, so it sounds like you start with, like, a coffee-based drink, and then you move to a sweeter one,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe a spicier one. I don't know.
Okay.
That's what it looks like is going
Cointreau,
on here.
Isn't Cointreau, is that, like, an orange flavor?
Yeah, I think so.
Or, okay.
Yeah. Yep. So the Benedictine has 27 herbs and spices, so, like, saffron, cinnamon, juniper, but apparently 6 of the 27 ingredients remain unknown.
Oh.
Like, it's only, like, it's exclusively made by, like, certain people.
Is it, like, the Benedictine monks?
Yes, exactly. It's been, yes. So, it was produced by monks since 1764. It's a cognac-based, and then aged and finished with honey. So, that's what makes it a Benedictine. But, seriously, there are, like, some ingredients that we, like, you can't produce it because we don't know what's in it.
That's amazing.
Isn't that so fun?
I hope those monks never lose a recipe.
Agreed. They won't.
No.
It's not possible.
No.
So there was a lot of drinking, and I was going to bring over one of these, but I forgot. And then we had wine. But,
well, for the coca vin, in the recipe that I had, it said to deglaze the bottom of the pan with some brandy. You're supposed to set it on fire. It said if you were too timid to set it on fire, you just let it bubble for a minute. I let it bubble.
You're like, I'm in an apartment complex.
Yeah, I don't need to set anything on fire right now. But yeah, brandy was suggested, but I used bourbon.
Okay.
I didn't have brandy.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
No.
It was delicious.
It was really good.
Yeah.
I will 100% make that again. And then
yeah.
I want to make the braised short ribs that you
yes.
made.
Mm-hmm. It was fine. It was good. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's doable, but it does take hours.
Yes.
And also, that one has to cook for 3 hours in the oven.
Oh, okay.
So you just have to start early.
Gotcha. Yeah, this one wasn't that bad.
Right.
Not that bad.
Only a couple hours.
Yep.
Total. Okay.
3 hours. I mean, it says 2.5 hours for the recipe,
oh.
but, you know, add in another hour for all of the chopping and
right.
all
yeah,
that
it
stuff.
Takes so much time. You got to do all those little pearl onions.
Fuck.
All right. So we're on our third chapter here.
We're breezing through.
All right, let's go.
All right, chapter 33. Peter!
What about
Peter? He is struggling in this book. Hardcore struggle bus. So Peter, he knows he shouldn't pester Clara about her work, but he just can't help himself. So he goes in to her studio, and he...
No, what does he do?
I have a quick quote about this part, so I'll reference it in a minute. But yeah, so he goes into her studio. He sees that she's frustrated. And then he says, and like as the words are coming out of his mouth, he's like, I shouldn't be saying this, but he can't help himself. Why don't we have a dinner party?
I know. Oh my God, I remember that part in the chapter. And I was like, shut the F up, dude.
She is so stressed. Why don't we just have a dinner party? Get your mind off of things.
I mean, listen, dinner parties do cure everything.
I mean, in one way, it probably is not productive to be sitting and fretting over something. Like, you do need to, like, kind of take a breath and, like, relax.
Yes, that's right.
So, in one sense, maybe it's not the worst thing, but if you know that something like that stresses somebody out or, you know, they have low social energy, then that can be a lot.
The thing is, though, she doesn't have to work on the painting because it is literally perfect as is, and he's the asshole that told her that, oh, but are the colors right? Right? Yeah. You know what I mean?
He's the one with a little worm in her ear.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, actually, she doesn't need to do any work on it at all. So, the dinner party worked.
Yeah, I'm just going to say the quick quote now because it makes sense.
Yeah.
Peter says to her, and again, it's words coming out of his mouth that he knows he shouldn't say, but Peter says to Clara, if you go into your studio now, you might mess it up even more. And Clara's like, wait, what?
Mess it up even, more? Get him out of here.
No, Peter. All right. You're staying on the struggle bus for a little longer. Okay, so there's a dinner party that's in the works. Gaburi wakes up Gamache, because obviously he's at the B&B, and hands him the newspaper, and there's, of course, another horrible news story. This time, the story is focusing on Annie, and with Paul Miron, who's a public prosecutor, implying that she's cheating on her husband with this man, and then also implying that because she's, you know, has this other love affair with him, that the prosecutor was able to get Gamache off of the murder case.
And so it was like collusion. Yeah.
So, of course, you know, Gamache calls Ren Marie and then calls Annie and, you know, has to figure that out. So that's still on. Oh, and then he also calls Rebouf to talk to him about the situation. And also because Brebeuf is Annie's godfather. And in part of that conversation, Brebeuf is like, in his own mind, like holding back his frustration. And it's kind of like, dude, Annie is your goddaughter. Right. I mean, I know she's not blood, but why would you do that to her? You know? Like, obviously he's in on it, so that's frustrating.
It's the worst.
It's the worst.
No, like, he's the worst.
Yeah. Trying to be a best friend, but not really a best friend.
Right.
Okay. Gamache then walks. He meets up with Clara, who looks like she's, you know, just hit by a bus because she's so stressed over this painting. And she agrees to walk with him. And then she has this really sweet feeling that she just feels whole around him. Like, you know, Gamache is just this safe space for her, which I think is really sweet. I know. You know, and she said, like, she can feel, you know, foolish or ill-constructed around others. But with him, she doesn't feel like that. Clara tells him that she really liked Mad and that Hazel was lucky that she was going to take over for Gabri as president of that Anglican church women group. And Gamache was like, is that really, do you think she was really happy about that? And she was like, oh yeah, have you ever met the Anglican whatever women? Clara didn't think that Hazel was going to be upset. And then Clara goes on to say that Mad and Hazel were a good team, where Mad made you feel really good about yourself, but then Hazel did all of the work. And I thought to myself, I'm like, is that really a good team?
Right. Is that a good team?
Right.
It's not like one's contributing something that the other one's not contributing. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just like one's doing all the work for the other one who's getting all the benefit.
Exactly. I don't really feel like that's a good team.
No. That doesn't sound right. I'm just, you know, aerating our wine over here. No big deal. Continue.
De-aerating.
De-aerate. Is that how I do it?
Uh-huh. And then just keep something.
Guys, listen to this. It's done.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Thank you for more wine, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now Gamache is curious why Mad wasn't murdered on the Friday night. Why did they wait until Sunday? I mean, that's an interesting question. If you had the opportunity on Friday, why didn't you take it then? Right. Something else happening. Yeah. I mean, that is kind of curious.
Right. If there was going to be a seance,
mm-hmm.
why didn't it happen that night?
Yep.
We shall see.
We shall see. And then there was a lot that happened, you know, leading up to the seance. You know, there was different people. Like, Clara was telling him about the night of the seance, the second one, and kind of the procession and, like, the different people who were talking to mm-hmm. others, mm-hmm. That there was, like, some arguing that was happening. She yeah. told him that Odile and Giles? That's not correct how you pronounce that.
Odile?
But now I like Odile and Giles.
Odile and Giles? Like, wait. That is, like, their perfect relationship name.
It is. All right. So Odile and Giles. they've been together for a few years after his divorce, mm-hmm. And we find out that Odile, it's not how you say it, but it's fine, is brilliant with numbers and really helped him to turn his store around, right. But all she cares about is people perceiving her poetry as being good.
Which is
interesting. And then it's also interesting because I think I had this in a quick quote, and I'll say that in a second, but what Gamache says to Clara about Odile's view of her poetry. And then lastly, Clara tells Gamache about the dinner party that's happening, and he asks her, he's like, can you invite Jean for me?
And she's like,
and Clara's like, meh. Yeah, I could do it. It's fine. And just tells him that she doesn't really like her. So
Clara doesn't like Jean.
Okay. I think she's kind of scared of her. Like, they're a little bit creeped out.
Yeah, in a way. That makes sense.
Okay, so quick quotes.
Mm-hmm.
So the one that I was just referencing about Gamache talking with Clara about Odile's poetry.
I love this name.
Odile's and Giles. So Clara was saying, you know, her poetry is awful. Do you really think that she thinks it's good? And Gamache says to Clara, it must be difficult to know, Gamache to Clara, regarding whether he thought Odile's poetry was any good. And that makes Clara take a step back and just adds to that anxiety of, like, she's like, shoot. Trying not to curse. Sugar, is that what I'm doing? Right. Do I really just not know that my work is not good?
Honestly, that is, like, yeah, that's such a scary thought. You know what I mean? Because you're never going to know what other people
mm-hmm.
think of it until they see it. And she's just sitting in her room, like, making all this stuff. And this guy's coming soon. And it's just like, it could literally go any way.
Yeah. Well, right. And then also, if it's something that you really do enjoy and, like, you mm-hmm. like what you made,
right.
but then someone comes along and says, no, that's not good, and that's heartbreaking.
That's so hard.
So there's this beautiful Harry Chapin song called Mr. Tanner, and it's kind of like this, in which there's this man who has a beautiful singing voice. He does the laundry, and he just sings to himself every night.
Oh.
And people will come by and say, oh, you have such a beautiful voice. And he was like, no, I just sing because I love it, and it just makes me happy. And they're like, no, you should really go and, like, audition. And he finally is like, all right, I'm going to do this. So he spends, like, his life savings. He rents out this big music hall. There's a lot of, like, hoopla about it. And he goes and he sings. And then the next day,
talent scouts? Oh, like the
critique people.
Yeah.
The critics.
The critique people.
They say, you know, it was, like, a nice show, but he's not anything professional. You know, there was all of these mistakes and just kind of, like, tear him down.
And, like, yeah, he's not a professional.
Right. But then after that, the song goes on to say that you never heard him sing again.
Oh.
But, like, in, like, the very quiet parts, you can hear him singing just a little bit because he sang because it made him happy, because it made him feel so whole. But it does make you, like, there's times where people do things that it's just for their own,
right.
like, pleasure.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't want to know what people think about it.
No, exactly. And if you can preserve doing something simply because you like it, I think that is, like, such a unique thing. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so you don't want to expose it to other people because you kind of like don't want to ruin it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And even if you were good too, it's just like having something that you don't even care. To have the feeling that you truly don't care about what other people think of your product or whatever, that would be, that's sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Hi. Are you winning petties?
It's almost their dinner time. The other, okay, so one more quote. Again, I love Gabri and Olivier. So the other, so this was the last quote. There was Gabri, his thick, dark hair standing up on one side like Gumby. He was unshaven and wore a shabby dressing gown and fluffy slippers. It seemed the more elegant and sophisticated Olivier became, the more disheveled Gabri grew. The universe in balance. Olivier must be particularly splendid today, thought Gamache.
Because of how they're just Gabri. Like, they yeah. have to be balanced out. So if Gabri's a hot mess,
yeah.
then you know Olivier is going to be
yeah.
in line.
It's going to look fantastic. Food, it was just coffee and croissants.
Oh, just croissants. Coffee and croissants. Mm-hmm. Croissants. Sign me up any day. Okay, so, all right, chapter 34. It's just some info. about the case. So Lacoste is actually out in Montreal interviewing Madeleine's ex-husband.
Okay.
Francois? Francois?
Sure.
Francois?
Francois.
And I don't know how to say her last name. I never say it, so I'm not
Favre. Going.
Favre?
I have no idea.
Yeah, Favre. So apparently he's super hot. I just had to throw that out there. It was an extremely important fact. He's super hot.
of course.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
so
Madeline would get the best.
Madeline is obviously the one that everyone wants. So she would clearly end up with a super hot dude. Mm-hmm. But I find it interesting that they divorced, right? Because, like, right. they would seemingly be the it couple,
mm-hmm.
you know? But people are complex. and yeah, she's just asking him, like, you know, do you know anything? Like, do you know anyone that would want to murder her? And he's like, no, you know, I don't know anyone that would want to murder her. But he did mention that it, quote, hurt to be close to her. And that also, she probably hurt people unintentionally. Like, she really was a nice person, but just the way she was and the attention that she grabbed and, you know, those kind of characteristics, it could potentially hurt people without sure. her noticing.
Right.
I think the it hurt to be close to her thing was that, yeah, like, he couldn't live up to, mm-hmm. like, who she was and the energy that she provided and right. that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's kind of interesting.
And I wonder, like, does that go back to the other person's own insecurities in a way? So if, like, everybody was, you know, super happy and confident and, you know, secure in themselves, would yeah. it matter if there was someone like Mad?
No,
Mad?
I don't think so. I think for him, while, like I said, it seemed like they would be, like, the perfect couple, I don't think he could live up to her, you know. He probably didn't feel good enough mm-hmm. being around her all the time. That's what I'm guessing. So then she also visits, Madeline's school.
Mm-hmm.
So the school issue keeps popping up here. She gets a bunch of yearbooks to look at and she sees Mad's photos, like, all over the school. She was in this club and this club and the leader of this, like, just, you know, everything.
Very involved. I don't understand those people.
Oh, no, no, no. No, I didn't do anything in high school. I mean, I danced, so I didn't have any time.
Yeah.
Also, no. Need to do fun things.
Yeah.
so, yeah, she's very involved, very popular. So then we're back in Three Pines, and the investigators are discussing the issue that you brought up in the last chapter is why Madeline wasn't murdered at the first seance. Mm-hmm. So they start listing things that were different between the two seances, which is really smart, right?
Right.
So Hazel and Sophie did not go to the first seance.
Okay.
But then they were convinced by Madeline, I think,
mm-hmm.
to go to the second one.
Mm-hmm.
So two people, those are like two prime suspects, right? Hazel and Sophie, because
right.
they were at the second seance. And then there was a dinner party that night. There was the location change, right? So that now it's at the old Hadley House. Jean Chauvet was more serious about the seance, and then there were candles and salt.
Okay.
So these are just all the things that were different about the two. So guys, if you haven't read the book yet, what's your prediction based on this list?
Okay. The salt.
It was the salt. I think the salt murdered her.
Yes.
Okay. They also discuss a photo of Sophie.
Of Sophie?
Yeah. Okay, so they found this photo of a kind of a chubbier looking person.
Oh.
And guess what? It was Sophie. So what does that tell you?
Sophie lost some weight.
Yes. So apparently they find out that Sophie usually fluctuates in weights, mm-hmm. in weight. So she's kind of been on a bunch of diets and all this kind of stuff. So they're like, all right, does this bitch have ephedra?
Right.
Right? So they go to her house and they search her stuff. In the bathroom, though, Jean-Guy kind of finds some interesting stuff. It is, like, chock full of medications and stuff because, basically, of all of Sophie's ailments.
Oh.
That Hazel is just always doting on her, right. And she's basically making it all up. It's, like, they kind of have, like, a combined Munchausen syndrome thing, like, the two of them together.
Right.
Like, she needs attention and to be taken care of, and Hazel needs to take care of people.
I mean, that's a good combo.
That is a good combination. Exactly. Both are getting something out of it. Yeah.
Symbiotic relationship.
I love it. Whoa. What's happening to my voice?
It's the weather.
Must be. It did get cold today for the first time in a long time. So, anyway, they find the ephedra.
Okay.
In Sophie's makeup case. She claims it's not hers, and she doesn't know where it came from. Hazel's, like, shocked and upset at Sophie, and she's like, Mom, it's not mine. Like, I have no idea where this came from. So, we'll
interesting.
See. And then later, Lacoste calls with a report on the fingerprints. So, if you remember, this happened so long ago, and I feel like they haven't talked about it in a while.
Right.
But the old Hadley house was broken into. After the murder. Like,
right.
They cut down the crime scene tape.
There was the dead bird, right?
There was the dead bird.
Okay.
Yes. And someone broke into. So they're also trying to, like, figure out who did that.
Sure.
So, The fingerprints came back.
Okay.
And they found out who it was.
Who is it?
Monsieur Bellevue.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Monsieur.
Yes, exactly. So, he's one that broke into Hadley House, and then Gamache visits him, and they kind of have this conversation. I didn't really want to sum up the whole thing, just kind of the main point. And it's really, really sad. And we have a really hard time talking about it right now, because he went there to kill himself. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, because he just lost, like, his long-term wife, and then very recently found joy in Madeline, and then she died. And he just couldn't do it anymore. So he went there, and then he, like, got this feeling, and he heard a noise, and he, like, chickened out and got afraid because he, like, in his mind was like, oh, I don't want to die like this.
Aww.
And he, like, flailed and freaked out and ran out of the house and didn't do it.
Good.
And in the process, he killed the baby bird.
Oh.
So it was just the baby bird
that
was making the noise, and that freaked him out, but the baby bird saved his life.
Oh, man. Oh.
Yeah, I'm like, I can't handle it right now. It was a really, really depressing end to the chapter. So, anyway, moving on to our quick quote corner.
It's kind of beautiful in a way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Everything she writes is beautiful.
Thanks, Louise Penny.
Thank you. Yeah. So this one's funny, so we can talk about that. So when they're talking about the case, Nicole poses an interesting point about the case. She goes, "Well, what's different about the two séances?" And she, like, you know, is like, thinks she's so smart. And it goes, "She sat back, triumphant. Oddly, no one jumped to congratulate her."
She's like...
So she just poses a question and then doesn't do any follow-up.
Yeah, she's like, so what's the difference about the two seances? Mm. And then she's like waiting for someone to be like, oh, that's so smart. Do tell. Like,
she gets no gratification.
Oh, she's so smug. It made me laugh. Okay, so back into, like, depressingness. Oh my god. Depressingness. Deep depression. Okay, so he's talking to Monsieur Bellevue about why he broke into the Hadley house and why he tried to commit suicide. And Bellevue was in the room where Matt died, and he said he felt a presence. And then he described it as the thing that killed Madeline. Like, he felt like the presence was there. Mm-hmm. And then Gamache says, so you chose life. And then Monsieur Bellevue says, no, I didn't. I was just too scared to die. Not like that, anyway. There's something in that house. Something attacked me. And Gamache said, not anymore, Monsieur. You killed it. And he said, I did? And Gamache says, it was a baby robin, probably as scared as you. And Monsieur Bellevue says, I was right then. The thing that brings death was in that room. It was me.
That is really sad. Because obviously he's thinking about, you know, his wife and Mad and the, baby, the baby bird. Yeah. Like, sometimes people, I feel like people do feel like that, you know, when you have enough of death around you, it's like, is there something about me that I'm meeting these people or, you know, and that's hard. That is hard.
I know, but I do like to think about the baby bird as saving his life.
Agreed.
Because this whole book, the baby bird dying, has been really sad, you know? It's just, why does it have to be a baby? But to think that it lost its life in... you know, for a meaningful thing. That makes me feel better about it.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to the bistro brief. There was some classic Tim Hortons double-double and donuts.
Double-double, toil and trouble.
And that day, I think, like, literally, like, the day after I typed up these notes, I went to Bed Bath & Beyond, and they had, like, a huge wall
of Tim Hortons
coffee, so I was really excited about it.
Nice.
Okay. All right, should we move on to 35?
35. Yes. And this is what I was thinking about before, with the quick quote corner.
Corner?
Corner. I didn't put it. Okay. So... now they are back in the incident room, and they're all discussing the case. And this is where Olivier comes in, and he's setting up soup. And he's setting the soup up underneath the list of murder suspects. Which I think is just amazing, by the way, that, you know, just the regular-ass town people come in. And
they just
have, like, all of the suspects out and about. But Olivier, in his mind, he's setting up the soup. And he's happy to see that he wasn't there, but happier to see that Gabri still was. Which is amazing. Your life partner. You're like, ha ha ha.
You're still on the list. Sucker!
So sweet. And then Olivier tries to eavesdrop, but only hears people eating, unfortunately. So he's trying to be sneaky sneak. So the investigators are now discussing the bottle of Ephedra. While Sophie starts, or wait, and Sophie sings, and then while Nicole is berating Robert for what she thinks is a dumb comment regarding Hazel's reaction towards Sophie's faked ankle injury. Mm. And Gamache just has enough of Nicole, and so he pulls her out of the room, and she thinks that, I don't know, he's probably going to tell her something good, but he sends her away to do a very long errand, and she's like, what's going to take so long? And he's like, I don't care. And Nicole tells him, you're making a mistake. And Gamache, in his all, like, serious face, he's like, no, I'm really not. I know what I'm doing. So he sends her away. When he comes back, Lacoste is mentioning that after speaking with Madeline in Hazel's school, she came away with the impression that Madeline was a bit of a legend, which I think we know from all of the pictures and everything that was of her. And she also discussed talking with Mad's ex-husband, who she said still clearly loved her, and then further saying that he pushed her into the divorce, mm-hmm. saying it was like living too close to the sun, which that's gotta be hard. Jean-Guy is now thinking about Sophie and how the ephedra was found in her room, but then also her intense feelings for Mad, and that she was at the second seance, but not the first. And that she sat between Monsieur Boulevet and Madeline. So now he's kind of like piecing these things together. Like, she really did have some of this motive and opportunity for potentially being the murderess. Murderess?
Yeah.
Murderess. And then we get more about Arnaud.
Ooh.
And this part of the book was like a significant part between Gamache and Zhangyi.
Is it my favorite part?
It probably is. So okay. This is,
do tell.
So Gamache finally again tells Zhangyi more about what happened with the Arnaud case. And so we find out that after a year of research, an emergency senior counsel meeting was called, and Gamache put forward all of the evidence. But he did it in kind of like just like slowly unraveling the case. And everybody around that table is like shocked and awe, except for Arnaud and Francois.
Francois.
Remember we heard it in the TV show?
Francois. Yeah. And Arnaud. And Arnaud, he could tell, was very uncomfortable. So Arnaud, after all of the evidence is presented, Arnaud eventually confesses to the crimes, the incitement of murder, and then to actual murder. But Arnaud was still able to convince the council, and this is like mind-boggling to me, but he's still able to convince the council that because of his position and everything that he's done, that he and the two other officers who are implicated should be given time to get their affairs in order, go to a hunting cabin, and then just kill themselves.
No, absolutely not. It's not like, how it works.
How do you convince a council of men? I mean, I get that they were doing it because they were trying to keep, like, their reputation.
Right, of the whole.
SQ. SQ, yes.
Guys,
we don't have to say that anymore. SQ.
Yeah, from the TV show, they were calling the, we can't say it, the Sûreté, du Québec. They're calling it the SQ, so now we can call it SQ from now on. Oh, I'm so excited.
Yep.
Thank you, SQ. TV show.
We just need little shortcuts.
Yes,
we
do.
Because we're not Francophones. I can't pronounce it.
So sad. Damn Anglophones.
So they were going to let them go and kill themselves. Gamache, being who he is, he drove to the suicide, and when he got there, the two officers were drunk, but they just cried in relief because they were so scared.
Yeah.
Arnaud, he was pissed. And then the council was furious with what Gamache had done because he went against...
Right.
What they had, like, agreed on doing. So he kind of, like, going against their orders. And then after Gamache is telling Zhangyi all of this, Zhangyi just gets so upset because he wants, like, how can I protect you? Like, I want to be able to protect you, but you don't let me in. And
Gamache, like, doesn't want to let Beauvoir know and in on everything, right? Because
right?
he wants to protect him.
Exactly.
But Beauvoir's like, no, dude, I gotta help protect you because you're the one that's like under fire here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a lot of frustration. And then finally, Zhangyi just finally snaps. He yells the F word at Gamache. And Gamache is just like, he's standing there, he's taking it because he knows that he just needs to kind of get this off his chest. And when Zhangyi finally gets it off his chest, Gamache, in a very, like, calming tone, he was like, you are going to be my successor. I love you like a son, and I need you. And it is just the most beautiful moment. And it's just, like, I don't feel like you often see this kind of, like, emotional connection between men. And Louise Penny just writes it so beautifully.
She does.
And it's kind of, like, between a father and son, but it's also kind of between two friends.
Yeah.
And Zhangyi just needed to hear Gamache say that, and they embrace. They have a hug, and Zhangyi is crying on his shoulder, and he also says to Gamache, I love you too. And that is just, it's the most beautiful end of a chapter.
Oh, thank you.
I loved it.
I needed that one.
And then really Gamache tells him everything about Nicole.
Oh, okay, perfect. He lets him in.
Finally lets him in.
He lets him in.
Yeah.
Aww. Oh my god, yeah, I totally cried reading that. I'm crying again
yes.
right now. You
yes.
were crying.
Yes.
Everyone was crying.
Ugh, such a good part to the book. I don't, read that chapter. If you don't read anything else, read that chapter. It was chapter 35.
Yeah, and this is really like the first time that you see how actual close they are, and it's just
in future books, you know, it's just like they're going to get closer and their relationship is going to be so meaningful.
Yeah. Yep.
Excitement.
But yeah, this is the first time that they finally are acknowledging how much they mean to each other.
They're family.
Fans. Yep. Oh, yeah. And this is also, Junkie also realizes, too, that he doesn't have any more envy of Daniel.
Oh, right. Because he
Gamache's actual, like, biological son.
Yeah. He was a little jealous of him.
Yeah. And he was like, it's fine now. More food in this chapter.
Do tell.
Chicken stew with dumplings.
Oh, who's eating that?
I think this is what Olivier brought to the incident room.
Right.
So chicken stew with dumplings, red lentil and curried apple soup.
I'm interested.
I'm super interested in that. And then there was another rich, chunky stew. For dessert, they had brownies. And they specifically mentioned the brownies had grilled marshmallows, or like flamed marshmallows on top. And then date squares.
Oh my gosh, I can picture that perfectly. So like a little square with the marshmallow and then a little candied date on top.
Oh, no.
No?
No. Two separate desserts.
Date squares.
Date squares.
Oh, yummy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The brownies was a brownie with a layer of marshmallow and then flamed like a creme brulee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or like a toasted marshmallow.
I've made a boxed brownie like that. Does that count? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just like dumped marshmallows on top of it and then put it back in the oven.
Oh, nice.
It worked so well.
Could do that into the brewer.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, two more chapters left because we're doing seven this time. I think we're doing pretty good. This one's kind of short.
Sure.
So chapter 36, weekly investigative report. So we start out in Monsieur Bellevue's little grocery store. There's a lovely description of Giles, Odile and Giles. Oh, Odile and Giles?
Yeah.
Is his name Giles? Why would I just say Giles right there? Anyway.
Because I think the probably the appropriate way to pronounce it is Giles. Okay. Giles. Giles. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to call him Sandin. His woodwork sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he loves trees.
Yeah. Can feel the spirit of them.
Yes.
And what they want to be.
So they sell his work in the grocery store. And it's, read it, because it sounds amazing. Okay, so Gamache and Beauvoir have a little conversation with Odile. Now I have no idea how to say anyone's name. With Odile. They ask her why she had an argument with Madeline, because we found out that she was arguing.
What was your deal, Odile?
Oh my god, it never ends. Okay, so she says that she told her to stop flirting with her man, Sandin, and to stay away from him.
Okay.
So whether Madeline flirts with him or not,
right?
She was perceiving that, and she was fed up with it. Apparently, like, Madeline denied it at all and was like, oh, I don't do that, and, like, Odile felt embarrassed. So then they go find Giles in the woods, and he tells a little bit about his background. So he used to be a logger, so, like, literally just cutting trees down. And then all of a sudden, he started hearing the trees scream. Like when they were getting cut down, he would literally hear them scream. And so his wife basically took the kids and left him eventually because like she just couldn't understand him. I mean, I probably wouldn't be able to understand him either. I mean, that would be hard. That is a very different point of view, right? And then they're like, oh, well, does Odile understand you? And he's like, no, but she accepts my world even though she doesn't live in it. So that's why the relationship works. Okay, then they ask what he thinks of Monsieur Bellevue, and apparently he fucking hates him.
Oh. What?
Yeah. So that's interesting.
He sells his stuff in the store.
He does.
Oh.
Yeah. I think it's because of Odile.
Gotcha.
But I think it's also like one-sided. Like Monsieur Bellevue may not really fully understand how much he hates him.
Mm-hmm.
He tells them a story about how Monsieur Bellevue had a tree in his yard that was had like a dying limb, and Giles, changing it every time I say it, he begged him to like let him cut the branch off because he could hear the branch screaming every day because it was dying.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you cut the branch off, it can save the tree.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when you cut it off, it can also kill the tree.
So it was, like, risky, but it was also just, like, clearly the tree is in pain and something needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And either it's going to die a slow death or, like, I'm going to cut it down and then it'll die, or I'm going to cut it down and I'll save it. So, like, clearly Sandin thought he knew what was best for the tree. And Monsieur Bellevue was like, no, if you cut that branch off, then you're going to kill my whole tree. Absolutely not. And he wouldn't let him cut it down. So Sandin had to listen to this dying tree for 4 years. And it took 4 years and the tree eventually did die. So he was right.
Yeah.
So then it just died this really slow, sad death.
Oh, man.
So now he has this resentment towards Monsieur Bellevue because of that situation.
Makes sense.
But, like, also, yeah, I mean, I don't know how I would act if someone was like, excuse me, your tree's dying. Can I please cut it down? And it like, to me, it looks fine.
Right.
You know? So that's why he doesn't like it. And then Gamache asks Sandin if he knows about the ginkgo tree, because he seems to know a lot about trees, so he's just asking him. He seems to know a lot about it, and it happens to be the tree that makes ephedra. So, just, you know, a little fun fact. And then there's one more article published about Gamache, but this time it's nothing about his family, just a photo of him claiming that he's a drunken idiot. So Gamache is, like, pumped about it.
Nice.
He's like, this is the best, like, trash article about me that there's been. So, oh my god, this is so repulsive. I can't wait. This is Gamache. Okay, sorry. I'm just, like, going.
You're fine.
We're in the quick quote corner now. I'm done with my investigative report.
Okay.
So, Odile, he goes, he could smell the sour wine imperfectly masked under a breath mint. It was a repulsive combination, and it was all he could do to not lean away when he was talking to her.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's too descriptive. I'm like, I can picture that. I can smell it right now.
Yeah, no.
Okay. And then Odile asks Gamache and Beauvoir if they'd like to hear one of her poems. And of course, Gamache is like, oh, yes, please.
Yeah, I love poetry.
I love poetry. Let's, and then, you know, he needs to get to know her, you know what I mean? And Louise Penny writes, Beauvoir tried to catch the chief's eye, but Gamache seemed oblivious of Beauvoir's ocular gymnastics. Because he's, like, trying to, like, be like, no, dude, we're not. I don't want to listen to you
recite poetry.
And Gamache is like, absolutely not. I'm not going to look at you, and we're going to listen to her.
Yes.
Okay. And then my last quick quote is about the last article that was written. It says, it was a strange world, he realized, as he and Beauvoir made their way back to the B&B with their dossiers and yearbooks, when a good day was one where he was only accused of drunken incompetence.
Amazing.
He's like, great day. Nothing crazy happened.
So, going back to Giles, do you think that could be like some sort of, we've been reading about synesthesia. Do you think that could be some sort of synesthesia? Like maybe he's just able to kind of tune into the pheromones, the chemical processes of trees?
Yeah, like I think – so synesthesia is a like combining an overlap of senses. So he could be seeing something in the tree that combines – so his vision combining with his like – sense of hearing, right? So then he starts to hear what they are feeling or doing. You know what I mean? That's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Again, or smelling, because
or smelling, yes.
Yeah, trees do have that.
Yeah,
and a way to communicate with each other.
And he might just have this scent that his brain then crosses over to his audio. So it's interesting because again, this is like a different character in the book, who also has, like, a magical...
That's true.
Fanciful thing in it. And they're all just, like, normal people. And they're just, like, totally... It's totally, like, acceptable what they're doing.
That makes me want to ask everybody about... What is something that you feel like maybe magical about yourself?
I have to think about that, too. Hey, look at those. I didn't know you had that on your fridge.
Yeah. The 3 pints?
That's our... podcast, whatever it's called, symbol.
Yeah.
Emily drew it, by the way, guys. I don't know if you know that, but.
I did.
It's pretty sweet.
And it's on my refrigerator.
It is.
The original.
OG. Okay.
Last chapter.
Yay, let's do it.
Chapter 37.
Okay.
There was a lot that also happened in this chapter. Okay. Bucking up.
Let's do it.
All right. So it's the dinner party, the one that Clara didn't want to have, but it's happening. And everyone is gathering at Clara and Peter's, including Jean. Clara, of course, she's still struggling with her stress regarding the painting for Fortin. So she's just still on the struggle bus. Yeah. And Jean is there, like I said. John Guy pulls her aside, and he tells her that they found no record of her high school, which she thought was weird. She's saying that's weird, but they found no record of her high school. Gamache and Ruth then have a fun back and forth with each other about their drinking. Ruth is referencing Gamache's recent article about, you know, he's drinking all the time. Yeah. But they're going back and forth and kind of rubbing each other about it. Like, why do you drink? Why do you drink? Gamache, I'm also picturing like this open room with a fireplace and table and warm lights and food being passed around. But everybody's kind of standing around somewhat in a circle, and Gamache is just throwing out these questions, trying to see, like, who takes the bait, because obviously it's still a murder investigation.
Of course.
They didn't all know that they were going to a murder party, you know, where it was, like, who done it?
Who done it?
Yeah.
But Gamache knew, but no one else knew.
So he's asking questions like, did you all know that Matt had cancer? Anybody? Anybody? And then he follows that up with, did you know that she had a heart condition? Not that she had a heart condition, but that the cancer was in remission.
Oh, right.
Or if they knew if it was in remission. So he's trying to see, like, what person is going to snag the bait. At another point, Jean, she captures the room with her discussion, which it kind of seems like a little bit out of character, but she captures the room with her discussion about paganism and how Christians, they...
That was louder than I thought it would be.
Heather's grabbing some water. It's very good for her. But how the Christians wanted to bring the pagans into their fold, and so they adapted some of their rituals, festivals, and then overlapped the Christian holidays with the pagan holidays. Mm-hmm. So, like, Christmas and Easter are really, you know, like, pagan holidays. But it just kind of is neat because it makes it seem like Jean wouldn't normally capture a room like that. But all of a sudden, she was kind of like the focus of this attention.
Yeah, because isn't she kind of like a mousy little, like, quiet thing? Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then the group also asks about Hazel and Sophie. And they say that Hazel turned down the invitation to join them for dinner. And they were all kind of like, is she the type of person that is so willing to help others but can't accept help for them herself?
Probably.
Yep. And then discussion, as table dinner discussions do, turns to Ruth and about her baby animals that she left back at home. And she gets very defensive about them. She insists that they are not chickens or ducks. Because I think Peter said that they had thought about eating Cornish hens, but he didn't want to, like, upset Ruth.
Right.
So they decided not to do that. But she's like, they are not chickens. They're not ducks. They're actually Canadian geese.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then she says that there's absolutely nothing wrong with Lillian. So there's Rosa and Lillian, and that Lillian has always been small. And this discussion leads Jean to ask, like, you know, how did you find them? Like, inquiring more about, like, their origin, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Ruth tells them that Rosa poked out of her shell really quickly, but Lillian needed, like, she could tell that she was struggling in the shell and that she needed, like, a little bit of help. And so she kind of helped peel away the shell for Lillian. And Peter says, he's like, oh, so you saved her. And Jean was like, I'm not so sure. And Ruth was like, what do you mean? She gets, like, all, like, frustrated. Yeah. And Jean was like, well, and she gives this example about this emperor moth that they spend so much time in their cocoons that they have to, like, push out in order, like, they don't all make it, but they have to push out and, like, to break free of the cocoon. But if they're able to do that, then that builds up their muscles so that they're strong enough then to go out in the world. And so Jean was kind of implying if you helped her, she may not yeah. have developed that kind of the skill, strength or strength. Will. Yeah. To.
So she actually contributed to her weakness. Yes. That's what Jean is suggesting.
Yes. But I think
that bitch.
That bitch. But I think that it's interesting that Peter was like, oh, so you saved her, you know, helping out the young, you know, yeah. seemingly
yeah.
incompetent little fledgling. And maybe that's his way of saying, like, he's hoping that that's what he's maybe done for Clara, as opposed to, like,
get out of here, Peter.
Getting herself. Right. Yeah.
No, right, for sure. There's, like, some hope in him. He's like, dude, hopefully I didn't screw it all
no,
up. You know what I mean?
He messed up. And so Ruth is obviously very upset about all of this. But Gamache, he breaks the awkward silence. He compliments Mira on her beautiful flower piece. And if you remember from, like, the very first book, she makes these, like, monstrous pieces that are fun and a little bit quirky and yeah. abnormal, like sausages hanging from branches.
But
and,
you know they're beautiful, too.
Yes, though. Yeah. And Gamache is like, I think there's something in here for me. And so he reaches in and he pulls out a book.
Naturally. Because what else would he pull out?
And also that this flower arrangement is so large, you can just, like, pull out a book from the inside of it.
Wait, hold on. I wanted to say this earlier and then I forgot. The fact that he is pulling books out of his pockets is so irritating to me because I've never once had a pocket in which a book could fit into.
We need to remedy that.
I know, women's clothes. That's what I'm saying. Their pockets yeah. are terrible.
So,
like, a book?
Yes. There is... would not fit in anybody's pocket.
Look, oh, this is... I could fit this book in my pocket.
You can.
These actually are really big pockets for sweatpants. But I would never wear these anywhere other than here.
So I was watching an Instagram video of a woman who makes all of her own period pieces. Mm. Not women's period, but like time period pieces. And she showed that kind of the origin of the pocket was they would sew a bag and it would have a ribbon that would tie around the waist. And then all of the skirts would have an open slit.
Yes.
And so they would have this large bag that would be hidden underneath, like, three or four skirts.
Dude.
And she was like, you'd be surprised at, like, the amount of stuff.
They would fit in their skirts.
Yeah.
Yes. So I, like, constantly read historical fiction. I'm, like, obsessed with other time, other eras and other places. And they always talk about hiding things in their skirts.
Yeah.
Like, and sewing things into their skirts, yes, too. Like, they'll the sew it so it doesn't look like it's a pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if someone were to, like, I don't know, capture you and, like, look at your clothing, like, yeah, there might be a pocket, but you actually sewed it into a different place that wasn't actually a pocket.
Yeah.
We don't, like, wear elaborate skirts anymore, so we wouldn't be able to hide shit in our tight-ass pants nowadays.
No. We would not be able to.
Our pants are so tight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, although...
I...
Baggy pants are back.
They're coming back.
Yeah.
I'm not sad about it. I do enjoy a purse, though, when I look at it, that can I fit a book in this? Like, if this is going to be, like, my day purse, if I'm going to want to go to a coffee shop or a restaurant and sit and have a glass of wine and read a book, I'm looking for a purse that will accommodate.
Yeah, agree completely. You need a purse that can accommodate a book, a phone, a chapstick.
Oh, a chapstick.
Mm. You always have to fit your chapstick. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What was I going to say? Oh, well. It's gone.
Yeah. Well, anywho's. So Gamache is pulling a book out of this plant. And and then Gamache brings out more books, the ones that he's been gathering from the different crime scenes. And Jean recognizes one of them. It's one of the magical books with a Hamsa hand. And she says it's an ancient symbol to ward off the envious and the evil eye.
Mm.
So that's kind of intriguing. And then the chapter ends with Ruth reading a Bible passage, because remember, that's one of the books that Gamache had picked up.
Just the Bible.
But, like, in my mind, I picture the scene where, like, the lights dim and, like, spotlight is on Ruth, and all of a sudden she becomes, like, this beautiful human being with, like, the buttery soft voice. Because that's what it says. Like, she all of a sudden gets, like, this she warm, changes. Beautiful voice. Yeah. As she's reading this passage.
I love that.
And then it's, like, she reads the passage, drops the mic, and then her alarm goes off. Because she set the alarm before coming out because she has to go back to check on Rosa and Lillian.
Okay.
So my quick quote corner is, yes, like, is about Rosa and Lillian.
Okay. Am I going to cry?
You know. Okay. Maybe. Okay. Ruth had kissed them softly on their little fluffy heads, getting a slight film of dander on her thin old lips. It's been a while since she kissed anything. They smelled fresh and felt warm. Lillian had bent down and pecked at her hand slightly as though kissing back. Okay. It's so freaking sweet.
It's too good.
And then Ruth stayed. Like, she meant to get to Clara's earlier, but she stayed because she was, like, tucking them in the oven.
Yeah.
She stayed a little bit longer until they fell asleep, and then she left. And then she set her alarm for 2.5 hours.
Okay.
All right. Well, you know.
That's I'm not sweet. Okay today. Seriously. I think this was a bad day to do this podcast. No, I'm just kidding.
The best day.
We had great conversations.
We did.
Yeah. We got through
it. So again, another chapter with delicious freaking food.
Yeah.
So this one at Clara and Peter's dinner, they had shepherd's pie, which made me think, I think it was book 2 where you made the shepherd's pie. That was one of, like, the most amazing things.
Oh, it was so easy and so good, yeah, right? We had, like, the potatoes on top of the beef. It was like a, it was a kind of a shepherd's pie.
Yeah. But it was really good. I thought it was shepherd's pie.
Well, it was like the Chinese version. Oh. It was like Chinese pie or something like that because it was, like, made from 3 ingredients or something. It was so good. But yeah, it's basically shepherd's pie.
Yeah. It was really good. They also had shrimp. Platters of shrimp.
I love shrimp platters. I love, like, cold shrimp. What is that called? Cocktail. Shrimp cocktail. Mm-hmm. I like it so much better than
And now you like the, you know that you like the cocktail sauce.
Oh my God. Guys, did we announce this? I like cocktail sauce. I thought it was foul my whole life. I had no idea because I never tried it because I hate ketchup and most other weird dipping sauces, but I love tomatoes.
Yep. And horseradish.
And horseradish, and that's all it is.
Basically.
I had no idea until Emily told me, like, a couple months ago.
Yeah. You just tried it for the first
this
time.
This year.
Yeah.
And it was good.
Yeah.
I've been,
like, shrimp cocktail. It's the shrimps in the cocktail sauce. Ah, so good.
I usually do, like, a lot of lemon juice, and it's delicious just like that. Yeah. But now that I know that I like cocktail sauce,
yes, I'm going to dip that shit in there. Well, my favorite dip from my grandmother that I think I know I've definitely made it for you at some point, and I don't think it's caught on amongst my friends, but that's fine. I still love it. But it's a cream cheese base, so cream cheese thinned out with a little bit of milk, a base of that, and then you put crab from like, you know, crab pieces, actual crab.
Like lump crab or something.
You spread that over on top of the cream cheese, and then you put a layer of cocktail sauce on top of that, and you dip in with Triscuits or meat thins.
Sign me up.
And
is it all cold?
Mm-hmm.
I would 100% eat that. That sounds delicious. Let's have that at our next party.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Also, random side story. So Troy's grandma, she lived in Florida when we all lived in Florida with her boyfriend. It's adorable. And they lived in Clearwater, and we lived in Tampa. So we would visit them every once in a while. Like, every single time we visited them, every single time, her boyfriend would buy us shrimp cocktail and this massive tub of, like, white cheddar cheese spread and crackers.
What?
Like, every single time we went there, those three things, crackers, white cheddar cheese dip, and shrimp cocktail. Was like, I don't know where he came up with this combination of items or, like, why he thought we wanted them, which we totally did.
Right.
But, like, I don't know where it came from. And it was, like, classic.
I mean, I feel like that's very much of a 1950s, 60s when you have guests coming over. The shrimp cocktail was a delicacy.
Yeah. I could totally see that. Isn't that so cute, though?
It is. Like, my grandmother, she would often have shrimp cocktail.
Aww.
But she would count out how many shrimp there are and would monitor how many people.
You only get 3.
Yes. She'd be like, oh, you already had your 4. It was so cute.
Well, yeah, you don't want someone to miss out on their shrimp cocktail.
No. Not at all. So, yeah, so they had shrimp and they had a lamb stew, fresh bread, fluffy mashed potatoes, and baby beans.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
What's baby beans, you think?
I don't know.
Like baby green beans or like navy beans or...
I have no idea.
I'm going to have to look that up. I need to know. Okay, so if our chapters next week don't have a lot of food in them, we've got so many options from this chapter, so that's what we'll do. Because I know like the next couple chapters are going to be really getting down to... Actually, that's it. There's only one more. There's only one more. So we'll see. See what happens. Okay, so right before we finish, we will end with some book recommendations. Mm-hmm. What have you been reading lately, Emily?
That's a great question, and I was thinking about that when I saw this prompt. What have I been reading? So, I know I went on a spree last podcast and talked about four different books. So
one only this time, please, Emily.
Yes,
I'm just
kidding. I think the one that you recommended for book club. Mm. So it's High Fire.
Oh my God, I have not even started it.
What?
Isn't that so... No, I'm sorry. I read two chapters, but I read it like 3 weeks ago. Is it good?
Yeah, I'm intrigued. Okay. I read it while walking.
Oh, fun.
Which like, is not safe. No, like actually read it.
Emily.
I know.
What?
Peripheral vision.
Where are you walking?
To my car from the VA.
I love you so much. Just walking while we're... Okay, I love it. You're like Belle.
Yeah.
She does it.
So High Fire. Yes. It's about the Louisiana swamps in a way, and there is a dragon, and there is a young boy who he begrudgingly starts to have interactions with. And it's just, it's interesting.
Yeah. I like their writing. It's different.
I could definitely see this becoming a movie if they have it in mind. Like it would make for interesting characters and a story plot.
That's fun.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read it. It is my book club pick. I will definitely start reading it soon. I have I don't know. I just feel like there's something that I have to do every single evening after work.
I have been having that same thing too.
Yeah.
When I was picking up, so that's my book club book. Another book that I'm interested in wanting to read, I picked it up when I was buying my book club book to bring to the party, is The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. The Zen... Hold.
Interesting, because I just heard Emily a couple days ago tell me she's extremely uninterested in Harley Davidson. So, tell me more about this motorcycle.
So, it's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And it's supposed to be a classic. I almost, brought this. There were so many books to bring. And I've heard really good things about it. I'll read the back.
Yeah, do it.
So, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, it was first written in 1974. And it's by Robert M. Persig. So, this is a narration of a summer motorcycle trip undertaken by a father and his son. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance becomes a personal and philosophical odyssey into fundamental questions on how to live. The narrator's relationship with his son leads to a powerful self-reckoning. The craft of motorcycle maintenance leads to an austerly beautiful process for reconciling science, religion, and humanism. Resonant with the confusions of existence, this classic is a touching and transcendent book of life.
Yeah, that sounds way better than what I thought it would have been.
Right.
Obviously, if you picked it up, and it says Zen and Art on the front, but when I got to motorcycle maintenance, I was 100% out.
Yeah, have talked about it.
Yeah.
And I think they have referenced it in terms of some other books that I've read, and that I would really enjoy this, because I think it kind of like, the Inner Game of Tennis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So that can, so I think it's similar to that.
Yeah, I think I would definitely like this. And it's really in a narrative, kind of written in a story form, fiction type way. So it's not going to be, boring or hard to follow, I don't think.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting. Okay, great. Great suggestions. So I have two. One I'm reading for my other book club is called Sign Here.
by Claudia Lux.
You haven't talked about this at all.
No, I haven't. I finished it. I really liked it.
Oh, you finished it.
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, this was for my other book club, which is tomorrow. So I had to finish it.
Gotcha.
And that's probably why I haven't been reading the other one. But it's so different. It, like, takes place partly in hell and partly on earth.
Okay.
And, like, the whole point of, like, hell is, like, get people to, recruit people to come to hell instead of going to heaven. So, like, you know, you've heard the phrase, like, he made a deal with the devil, right? Mm-hmm. So, the people who work in hell and go to hell, they end up working there. Their goal is to, like, get people who are good and who are, like, probably not going to go to hell to, like, make a deal so that they end up going to hell. So, for example, you might be a good person, but you might be so desperate in a situation that you're willing to sign a deal with the devil.
Hmm.
The simplest example is, like, at the very beginning of the book, there's a kid who, like, has really, really pressured parent or parents who are pressuring her to be really good and successful, and she's terrified that she's not going to get into Stanford.
Yeah.
Which is, like, yeah, you're not going to get into Stanford. So she's just like, please, I'll do anything, blah, blah. You know how you, like, pray when you just need something so bad?
Yeah.
And so then he pops up and he's like, oh, you'll do anything? He's like, all right, if you just sign this form right here, I'll let you get into Stanford and you'll live your life completely normally. I won't interfere. I won't kill you, blah, blah, blah. But then when you die, you come to hell. And then people do that shit.
Interesting.
Yes. So anyway, it's a kind of a story of some people on earth and then a story of some people in hell and how the stories are going to overlap. It's really good.
Interesting.
It's, like, super different from anything I would have ever read. It's really funny. It's, like, written in, like, a light way. And the characters are really interesting.
Cool.
Okay, so that's my one suggestion. And then I think you already suggested this a while back and I'm finally reading it, so I just wanted to point it out. I obviously am loving every second of it. It's The Book of Lost Names.
Oh, okay.
By
how far into it
Kirsten
are you?
Kirsten Harmel. I'm 65% done. Yeah, it's, you know, guys, I think Emily and I are on a path towards reading every single World War II historical novel there is, and we're totally okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is a really good one. And I know you haven't read The Nightingale yet.
No, I have not.
And there's some similar themes.
Okay.
So that's why it's interesting to me, like, to read it in a different form.
Oh, gotcha.
But someone in The Nightingale does something similar to this book.
Okay.
It's really
cool.
So anyway, those are our suggestions. No more. We're done.
No more. No more.
Emily would like to continue on to chapter 41 now. I'm just kidding. We're going to stop. We've been talking for like 5 hours.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to cover chapters 38 through to the end, which is 44.
Find out who the murderer is.
We're going to finally find out, guys. So chapter 38 to 44, The Cruelest Month by Louise Penny.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget Armand's wise words of wisdom. Why can't I say that phrase? I've changed it to his wise words of wisdom, which makes,
I think that's beautiful. Wise words of wisdom.
This is so redundant. His wise words of wisdom.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's true.
Wise words of wisdom.
Alliteration.
It is alliteration.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make it harder to say, you know? Mm-hmm. So, Emily, will you please tell me Armand's words of wisdom?
I don't know. I need help. I'm sorry. And I was wrong.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
This podcast was recorded and edited by Emily and Heather. Our music is by Robert Sellis.